It's Food Friday, and it's not just any old Food Friday. It's also the birthday of our stupendous Central Time producer, Amanda Magnus. So a big shout out to say
happy birthday, Amanda. We decided to use Amanda's birthday as an excuse to talk about almost everybody's favorite kind of cake, I think. Birthday cake. It's not just the cake itself. There's tradition. There's culture around it. Maybe something that sprung up around the kind of cake we make on birthdays. Maybe the one mom made for you every year because you liked it best. Maybe it's one that's been passed down in your family for generations. You can tell us your family birthday cake tradition right now over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Kristen McGlory is with us now. She's executive editor of food52.com and the author of Genius Recipes. Kristen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so with the whole world, it's full of donuts and cookies and cakes and brownies. Why is birthday cake in particular, still so special?
I think because it's something you can look forward to every year. And, you know, kind of no matter what, someone is going to make you what you want. whether that's the cake that you had every year since the beginning of time, or if that's this year you want something different and off the wall, like, you can probably get someone to make it for you.
Seems like birthday cake, that's time where you're going to go guilt-free. Even if you're careful, you watch what you eat year-round, the birthday is the one day that you can give it up for whatever dessert you want. You know me, I give it up for treats pretty much every
pretty
day.
Pretty much every day.
But, you know, there's that guilt-free angle to it, right?
Well, yeah, it's a day that doesn't really, it's only one day of the year. So, like, actually, there are a lot of people here at Food 52 who have, like, a birthday cereal tradition where they'll get one box of their favorite, like, sugary kid cereal every year. So every other day they're trying to be sensible and eat, you know, whole foods and things that are going to make them, you know, feel strong through the day. And then on their birthday, they just go crazy on a box of Cinnamon Toast Crunch or something like that.
Well, at Food 52, one birthday cake in particular has really hit the big time with popularity, and it's something called chocolate dumpet cake. And this isn't an ordinary cake. It's got a history and a following. Can you give us some of the backstory here for the chocolate dumpet cake?
Sure. It comes from Amanda Hesser's mother. Amanda Hesser is one of our co-founders of Food 52, and she's had the dumpet cake served on her birthday for years, and now it's a tradition in her family. And she's actually written about it when she used to work for the New York Times. She wrote about it in her book Cooking for Mr. Latte, and she's also shared it on Food 52. So it's become not only a tradition for her family, but also even a tradition at the Food 52 offices. You know, when a staff member has a birthday, a lot of times chocolate dumpet cake will make a showing.
Now, give us some of the basics. What makes this cake special? How do we make it?
Sure. Well, the name kind of gives a hint at it. It's a really simple cake to make. You basically heat up a few things on the stove, which already is pretty unusual, because normally when you're making cake, it will usually start with creaming butter and sugar and, you know, waiting until the butter gets to be just soft enough to cream and whip in air and, you know, make a nice airy cake with a nice crust. And this is totally different. It starts with you heating up some water and some chocolate and some sugar on the stovetop, and then you cool it a bit, and then you dump all the other ingredients in, basically. So that's where it gets the name dumpet cake. So it, what that does is, instead of being this kind of, you know, airy cake, it's very dense and moist, and it's almost the texture of like a chocolate steamed pudding. But that makes it really delicious and really memorable, which makes it really perfect for birthday cake.
I'm a big fan of chocolate steamed pudding, so I guarantee that at some point I'm going to be trying this cake. And this is, by the way, this recipe is posted on the Central Time Facebook page right now. So we talked about the cake. It's very dense, and you heat up the ingredients. What about the frosting?
The frosting is really simple, too, and it's just two ingredients. It's chocolate chips and sour cream, and they're brought to kind of the same warmish temperature. It needs to be the same temperature because otherwise it might get a little bit grainy. But they're just whisked together and smoothed onto the cake. And that means that it's a little bit tart and tangy, which is really nice. So it's good for kids, but it's also really appealing for grown-ups too, because it's not a super sweet cake or frosting.
It sounds, sounds great. I haven't tried this exact cake yet, but yeah, I will too, probably. How about the traditional, you know, you've got yellow or white cake and creamy frosting. Do you have any favorite preferences for a traditional birthday kind of cake?
Oh, gosh. I feel like everyone has their own you know, they really love, like, the yellow cake with the chocolate frosting or the yellow cake with the white frosting. Everyone kind of has their own favorite of that. I would have to say mine is probably yellow cake with chocolate frosting if we're going, like, a very traditional birthday cake route. But there's actually a recipe on Food 52 that does that, but it does it in a very grown-up way. It's called grown-up birthday cake, and it actually has, I think, white wine in the cake filling and olive oil. So it's a very... like moist and very perfumed cake.
Now hold on.
So that might be my favorite variation on that theme.
Well, one, I don't know if I want to be grown up while I'm eating cake, but two, olive oil and wine in a cake, what does that do?
Yeah. Well, and then there's also, I think, like a thin layer of like raspberry jam in the middle and then a chocolate frosting. And it's grown up enough that you could, you know, a grown up can eat a whole bunch of it, but I think that it appeals to your kid side too.
All right, well, we're talking right now to Kristen McGlory, executive editor of Food52.com, the author of Genius Recipes, 100 Recipes That Will Change the Way You Cook. Today on Food Friday, we're talking with her about the tradition of the family birthday cake.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have a go-to family birthday cake, the one that gets baked every year because you love it or someone in your family loves it? Do you have a birthday cake that's been passed on through the generations? If it's not a cake that you eat on birthdays, what do you eat instead? My kids go for brownies with frosting. Go figure. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking this Food Friday about birthday cakes and birthday cake traditions. What family birthday cake traditions and recipes does your family have? Do you want a particular cake every single year, like pretty much I do every single year? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Kristen McGlory stays with us. She's the executive editor of Food52.com and the author of Genius Recipes. 100 recipes that'll change the way you cook. Let's go right to a caller. We've got Holly on the line with us in Platteville. Holly, hi.
Well, hello.
All right, what's your cake story, Holly?
Well, I'm the mom and wife in our family, so I'm responsible for all the birthday coverage. And in our family, we get requests from fresh-baked cherry pie, ice cream cakes. But when I have to get my own cake, I'm always going for the grocery store marble cake with the fabulous sugar and shortening frosting and lots of flowers.
Real flowers or like frosting flowers?
Lots of frosting flowers.
Okay. Is there an argument over who gets the big flower, the piece of the big flower on it?
Oh, it's always mom.
All right.
Hands down.
You win on your birthday. That's awesome, Holly. Thank you so much. So decorating cakes, Kristen, whether we're getting the store ones or decorating ourselves, is that an important part of the birthday cake, getting lots and lots of fancy decoration on it?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you have definite preferences on whether it's going to be something with lots of flowers and lots of frou-frou stuff on it or just kind of like down to business frosting. Actually, the Dumpet cake we were talking about earlier, Amanda's mom always did a very fancy presentation with little piped rosettes all over it and then like a little sliced almond pressed into each one.
Wow.
And Amanda herself, when she's serving it, just goes totally minimalist and modern and makes it a very flat layer of frosting all the way around.
So lots of different options there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rob looks puzzled.
You can really tailor it.
Oh, I just wanted to ask Kristen, I'm a guy, if I'm making cake, I'm going to use a cake mix. I'm not a scratch cake maker. Can you make the case? There's a lot of rhymes going on. Can you make the case that I should make the cake myself from scratch?
Absolutely. You should. There's just no question. Making cakes is so easy. There's no, by the time you've opened the box, you've gone to the store, you've bought the box, you've opened the box, you have to add stuff to it. It's not like it's just ready to go. You have to add like oil and eggs, like basically all the ingredients that you would have to add if you were making it from scratch. The only thing that you have in the mix is that the dry ingredients are already mixed together. So there are so many cake recipes that will take you exactly as much time, if not less, that are from scratch and taste so much better. So I think you should change your ways.
I agree. That's two against one, Rob.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's not really simplifying things all that much when you put it that way.
No.
There's a cake I make, and I love to have people make it for me. It's one of Ina Garten's recipes, otherwise known as the Barefoot Contessa. And she, I think it's called Beattie's Chocolate Cake. And her secret ingredient is coffee, strong, hot coffee. But it really makes the chocolate flavor pop all that more. Have you seen coffee as a secret ingredient in cakes?
Yes, absolutely. And actually, you know, they'll even use like instant espresso or something, but just having a little bit of coffee will, you might not even taste the coffee, but it will round out the chocolate flavor. And there's actually a recipe, Nigella Lawson's Dense Chocolate Loaf Cake, that I think is just perfect as it is. But when we posted it in Genius Recipes on Food 52, all of our readers who wanted it to be more chocolatey, they kind of went rogue and started adding both more cocoa and more chocolate, or more coffee, excuse me. So, you know, it takes all kinds.
That sounds fantastic. So my go-to for a while, we had a friend who made an awesome flourless chocolate cake. If I had the option, I would request that. Veronica, the one you just mentioned.
It has flour. Right.
But that's your go-to one.
It is my go-to one now, but maybe 5 years ago I went for a Tunnel of Berries one, which had just what it sounds like, a tunnel of strawberries and cream in the middle, and that was amazing. Ooh. But, you know, you had to mix it up once in a while.
And Kristen, it's your birthday. It isn't today, or unless, you know, coincidence. It could be. But if it is your birthday, what's the cake you're looking for?
Oh man, that's a really good question.
So you're not committed. There's not an every year cake for you.
There is not an every year cake. And actually, you know what, my birthday is at the end of August, and so I get really excited about like a summer fruit cake, like a plum tort, that sort of thing. Like Marion Burroughs's purple plum tort is like kind of a dream for me when plums are in season.
That sounds good. Here's a question. What makes a tort a tort?
That is, I am so lost on that question, actually. Like, I think that, you know, because also there's a tort that's my favorite thing that my mom makes me, that is, it's not a cake at all. It's got a graham cracker bottom crust with some walnuts in it, and then a layer of sort of like a fluffy cream cheese, almost cheesecake-like filling, and then the top layer is basically like the inside of a blueberry pie, but it doesn't have crust on the side. And so it kind of looks fancy because it's got these like beautiful layers when you unmold it, but it's not a cake. It's not a pie. It's apparently a tort.
It's its own thing. It's a tort. Well, Kristen, Before we let you go, I know that you've been having this conversation with the Food 52 community, and there's one cake you drew our attention to earlier. One reader had to tell you about this crazy Teddy Graham cake, and there's a picture of this up on the Central Time Facebook page. What was that story?
Yeah, we were all talking about, actually, this wasn't a reader. This was one of our team members here at Food 52 named Hillary Pollock. She's on our customer care team. And we were all talking about the things that our moms made us. And she said that for her birthday, she could request whatever she wanted. And 1 year, she chose this Teddy Graham swimming pool cake that she saw on the cover of, like, a Family Circle magazine. And it's so elaborate. It's got, it's basically like a big white cake that has the middle kind of tunneled out, like you were saying, but it's filled with blue jello so that it looks like a swimming pool. And then there are Teddy Grahams swimming in it, and there are, like, sticks of gum for diving boards and little, like, peach gummy rings for, like, flotation devices. It's very elaborate, but she said that it was a bit of a disaster because by the time that you cut into the cake, the jello kind of floods out, and it sounds pretty disastrous, actually.
But you got to see it. You really have
memorable
to see it. Yeah.
Kristen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That's Kristen McGlory joining us to talk about birthday cakes. She's executive editor of food52.com and author of Genius Recipes.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
The Department of Justice announced today that it's dedicating $20 million to fund police body cameras at police departments around the country. The move comes after a year of protests over police community relations, particularly the use of lethal force against black men and boys.
A 2013 study has shown body cameras to reduce the incidence of use of force by police officers and the number of citizen complaints. But even supporters of the cameras say there are important policy questions that need to be sorted out before they can be used widely.
Here with us now to talk about some of those questions is Cami Chavis-Simmons, professor of law and the director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University. She's also a former federal prosecutor. Cami, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Cami, how big a deal is this that the Department of Justice is putting $20 million into the body camera pilot program?
Yes, I think that this is significant. First of all, of course, we know that there's been a lot of buzz, a lot of discussion about body cameras and how they can be helpful in terms of creating more transparency and perhaps accountability with local police departments. But it's easy to say that and make that a policy proposal and make it a priority, but it's very difficult to do that if you're a municipality and you don't have the budget for it. So that's why this $20 million infusion is so important. My understanding, though, is that it is $20 million that will be awarded to 50 programs or police departments for pilot programs, which is still, again, very significant.
So I guess the big question here is if police departments around the country go ahead, begin to use body cameras, are the results there? Do we know that body cameras result in less use of force and fewer citizen complaints?
Well, I think that there is some evidence. I certainly think that this is a new technology. I think there's a misconception that police departments have had this technology and have been using this technology and that it's been available. And that's true, but there's just a very small number of police departments who have this in any widespread use. So the empirical evidence is very scarce. I suspect that there will be more studies as more departments begin to use them. There's been three significant studies, small but significant studies, Rialto, California, one from Mesa, Arizona, and then most recently, I think the results were released just in March, from San Diego, California. So those are three of the studies that you will see cited, and each of them suggests that officers who wear the cameras participate in less uses of force, and they have less they experience less complaints from citizens. The reasons for this could be twofold. Of course, when the officers know that the public is watching, they may be likely to alter their behavior just in terms of de-escalating or trying to de-escalate. But also citizens change their behavior if they know that officers are wearing body cameras as well.
And Attorney General Loretta Lynch has said in a statement that body cams will benefit the public as well as the police officers. How so?
Well, I think that when you have a lot of advocates in the wake of all of these different tragedies, really, these officer-involved shootings from Michael Brown to now Freddie Gray. Michael Brown in Ferguson and Freddie Gray in Baltimore. The incident that happened there was not a camera in that instance. We know that there was a camera when Eric Garner was killed in police custody. So in terms of protecting the public, the more transparency, I think the better as far as the public is concerned. But they also do protect police officers because, as I indicated earlier, if citizens are more likely to beyond their best behavior, for lack of a better phrase, if citizens are behaving differently, that can serve certainly to protect officers. Also, having that footage there can protect officers against false complaints as well. So it's good to have this transparency. And of course, these body worn cameras are not a magic bullet, and I know that there are many concerns.
It's interesting to look at the Rialto test case that you talked about. In Rialto, the police force was reluctant. I guess it was a hard sell to get them to use the body cams. But one thing they were told to encourage them to try this out was that there were already lots of citizen phones out there that could capture footage anyway, and that this would represent the officer's point of view. How do you think those two things are different?
Well, I think that they're different in several respects. First of all, when you have citizens with the footage, they are certainly not as close as the officers are to whatever incident is occurring. But also, and citizens, their cameras, you know, may not capture the entire incident. They may walk in and begin recording the use of force, but there could have been a lot of behavior prior to that that would make that use of force be deemed reasonable. And so the footage from a citizen's camera could be very misleading. Now, as far as officers are concerned, that's still a possibility. In fact, that's one of the concerns when we're thinking about body cameras and the operating procedures and policies. When do officers turn them on? Are they mandated to keep them on? Or do they turn them on pursuant to internal department guidelines? Do they have discretion to turn them on? And so depending upon the answer to that question, also will impact the footage and the reliability, really, of the footage in terms of being able to explain any particular incident.
Now, as body cameras get picked up by more police departments, there are lingering questions out there that haven't been answered yet. And among them are privacy concerns. Who gets to see this footage? What if the camera is used during interviews with rape or abuse suspects? And what happens to privacy then? What are some of those questions that we still have to untangle?
Yes, so you've identified there in terms of privacy, it's a huge concern. Obviously, citizens have a reasonable expectation of privacy under the Fourth Amendment. And if officers, however, if officers are legitimately in a place where they're able to see things, in those circumstances, then anything that the officer would capture on the videotape would not necessarily be an invasion of privacy. But when we think about this footage becoming public, that's one of the concerns. Are these is the footage going to be subject to information requests? Are we going to release this footage publicly? The concerns about minors and sexual assault victims is also a huge concern. And policies, there are policies that can deal with any of these in different ways, having exceptions for sexual assault victims who would not like to be interviewed and allowing that person to consent to be interviewed without the camera. There are policy fixes or solutions for that, but any time we begin to consider that, we have to consider any negative impact that might have on the accountability issue.
And you got to assume on another point that this is going to be a lot of footage, a lot of police officers out there, a lot of footage. What happens with all the data?
Yes. So another concern and when we're thinking about this and drafting policies is the retention. How long do we keep, how long would a police department keep the footage or retain the footage, and for what purposes would the footage be retained? There are different technologies that are involved, and I suspect that the more these cameras are used and the more police departments use them, the market will become more competitive, and you'll be able to do different, there'll be lots of different types of cameras that you can buy and types of systems to download that data. I know that another concern some folks have is, are the officers responsible for downloading the data, or does it, would the technology allow the data to be automatically downloaded and there would be no possible claim of interference from the officers? So there's just a lot of different issues that have to be considered.
Now, Cammy, as this $20 million gets spent and this pilot body camera program proceeds, how do you think the results should be evaluated to determine if they're working, if it's a success?
Yes, I think that there should certainly be a study,
Cammy,
that would... There should, yes, I'm sorry. There should certainly be studies conducted, and I think you'll see a lot of social scientists. Once we have the data, you know, it's, we have these three pilot programs, the programs that I mentioned previously, but as more departments use them, they will be responsible for for analyzing the data. And of course, as part of any federal funding, when the funding is given, there needs to be a determination as to the effectiveness. I mean, this is it's quite a bit of money, quite a bit of taxpayer money, and we don't want to throw money at an issue, at a solution that's not effective. So one of the questions would be, and I think some of the studies have addressed this, do you have less complaints against officers, less uses of force than you did previously? And there are lots of different ways, I think, to measure that.
And can we just briefly, before we let you go, this is the DOJ's first big announcement with Attorney General Loretta Lynch at the helm. Can we glean anything from this about what her priorities will be and how she's going to continue this conversation about race and policing?
Yes, I think that Attorney General Eric Holder really, again, had an interesting last year or so in office with respect to the issue of police accountability. And it's only going to continue, I think, now, especially with the unrest in Baltimore and, again, the recently announced charges against those officers there. But I think that it's an important criminal justice priority, police accountability. You know, public safety is always, that is for politicians and elected and appointed officials, that's a popular concern, you know, public safety. But now we also see that it's important to keep those officers who serve us accountable.
Cami, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Cami Chavis-Simmons, professor of law and the director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University. The Department of Justice announced today that it will dedicate $20 million to funding police body camera programs around the country.